I posed our special guest for tonight as a kind of mystery when we opened a few minutes ago before the newscast. I was asking who fits the following bill, who fits the following description. A very distinguished American writer, I might add, won the Pulitzer Prize, has written on the development of the nuclear weapons, has written on the mad cow disease and the larger pattern of disease to which that belongs, has written a fine autobiography, has written on crime and theories of violence, and has also done a recent book on the Einsatzkommandogruppen, that is, the groups that dispatched 1.5 million Jews before they started incinerating them in the ovens during the years of the Holocaust, and now is the author of a brand new book about a fascinating American figure, John James Audubon, subtitled The Making of an American. Have you guessed yet who that is? Well, if you read any of the literary weeklies, you know I'm talking about Richard Rhodes. And it's a pleasure to have you here again.
It's a pleasure to be here again.
I think this is the fourth time around, probably.
Yes, right.
And every time I see you, you got into a new area and done a wonderful new book. What, after all the other stuff that you've done, which I've just reviewed,
yes.
What brought you to a straight biography? Have you ever done a biography?
No, and that's one of the reasons. I've never before done
yeah.
a biography. I've done, of course, brief biographies within the compass of historical
yeah.
works, but to spend a whole book on one person's life was a really intriguing and exciting thing to do. Audubon, simply because he's always intrigued me, and most of my writing has been about America in one form or another. We, after all, invented those nuclear weapons. So Audubon fit the bill as someone to spend some time with, and I was amply rewarded. He's a funny and interesting man.
But of course, he's not exactly an American. He's actually the secret king of France.
Yes, you know.
There
While
was
I
for a
was.
long time, there was a rumor that he was the Dauphin.
And indeed, his daddy, Victorian granddaughters, believed that.
They did, actually.
And when you go through the letters that he wrote at the libraries, you find places where parts of the text have been blotted out in India ink. They, like government censors, got rid of all reference to his childhood that contradicted their theory. But while I was working on this book, a French scientist, a French biologist, took a piece of the heart of the Dauphin that's buried in the chapel in Paris and compared its DNA to the DNA of some of the king's descendants and confirmed that that heart, which they know who it came from, was indeed the lost Dauphin.
That Dauphin was the son of Louis the XVI.
That's right. The little boy who was up in the Bastille and who probably actually died of tuberculosis.
And it would have been the King of France but for the revolution.
Yes, but he was born the same year as Audubon, so one can
Yeah.
see where that came from. It was a terrible shame and sort of a crime to be an illegitimate child in France at that time.
And that's just what Audubon was.
Yes, and you couldn't inherit property. So it was a deep, dark secret that he kept very carefully all his life.
I did not know, in fact, that Audubon lived the first 14 or 15 years of his life, well, actually the first 18, I guess, basically in France. And
Yes.
he observed the revolution, or a good portion of it.
They lived through the revolution. His family lost a great deal of its wealth because it had been a rather wealthy family. Then they went through something I think even more formative for a young 11-year-old John James Audubon. They went through the Terror, which was at its worst in Nantes, the town where he
Yeah.
grew up. They saw people being slaughtered in the streets. They saw this monster that the committee had sent out from Paris, Jean-Baptiste Carrière, walking through the streets shouting, "Kill the children! Kill the children!" This little boy, this very sensitive little boy. I think there's a reason that he found a way to look at feeling and the complexities of emotion through birds
Yeah.
rather than directly,
How
sort of
interesting.
allegorically.
Yeah. And birds had a kind of freedom that he must have longed for.
Indeed. His favorite book was the Fables of La Fontaine. He used to carry a copy with him when he went out into the wilderness. And if you think about carrying everything with you when you're walking through the primeval American forest, you only carry the things you really need to carry. So he, and that collection of fables where animals talk and live and have complexities of life like human
And
beings.
the smartest and most tricky of them all is the crow, as I
Yes,
remember it.
yes, yes.
He fools all the other
That's
more
right,
powerful
which
animals.
they do. Crows are indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you mentioned he was illegitimate. Let's get briefly
Yeah, frame him.
round out and frame his origins, and then we come to his career.
Audubon's father was a sea captain who parlayed his cargoes into enough wealth to buy a sugarcane plantation on the premier foreign colony of France, which was called Saint Dominique, and which then became Haiti after the slave rebellion there. Audubon was the child of a French chambermaid in his father's house in Saint Dominique. His mother died when he was 6 months old. So he was raised there until he was six, presumably by other women in the household. There was another illegitimate child who, by another woman, and perhaps a third as well. But his father saw that the slaves were beginning to rebel in the north of the Cove Haiti and had the good sense to sell his plantation for whatever he'd get for it and get out. And he took this little boy, Jean Rabin, and the little girl Rose back to France with him, where he had a wife who was 7 or 8 years older, had been a widow, was childless. This evidently a marriage of convenience, but clearly also a companionable marriage. And this lovely woman took them in, and they gave the boy and the girl the Audubon name. They baptized them, so they became legitimate thereby. There was, of course, always a hint of scandal in the background, and many years later, when his father died, other relatives tried to claim the estate and so forth.
What year is it that he arrives in this country?
So he arrived in this country in 1803.
And he's 18
August,
years old.
And he's 18 years
arrival.
Old. He came over because he was his father's only son. His father didn't want him conscripted into Napoleon's army, which was fighting England at the time. So he procured a false passport for his son and sent him over here to live on the plantation in Pennsylvania that he had bought with the money from the plantation in Haiti.
And when he arrives, he is not an Anglophone.
Doesn't speak a word
Not a word of English.
But he had the good fortune, if you will, to contract yellow fever within a couple of days of his arrival. The captain of the boat was in charge of him and concerned for him and sent him to a boarding house run by two Quaker ladies who, across the next 3 months, nursed him back to health. So that ever after, with a very charming French accent, he spoke Quaker English. He didn't doubt everybody.
When he writes to his wife, he tutoies her in English.
That's right.
He calls her thee and thou.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, which is quite charming.
Yes.
Did he do that with everyone?
He did selectively.
Yeah.
Friends.
Probably use it the way the French would, as a sign of intimacy.
That's probably
closeness.
Right, because of course he didn't do it with the Earl of Derby.
Yeah.
So, that was my lord.
So, 18 years old, there he is. He's not fully lettered. He's not deeply educated.
No, he's not. The schools closed in France. They broke down. The social system broke down.
So how does he become the Audubon we know?
He really was an extraordinarily self-made man. He had evidently had some training as an artist up to his 14th year, because much later he would make a living drawing portraits without having to learn how to do that. So he obviously already
his
knew.
His famous black chalk
portraits, yes. Yeah. But his bird drawings were apprentice at best when he was 18 years old. Recently, in the museum in La Rochelle, France, down the river from Nantes, they've turned up in the papers of one of Audubon's mentors 120 early Audubon drawings that haven't seen the light of day for more than 100 years.
Are they portrait drawings?
No, they're drawings of birds.
They're birds even that early.
Yes, drawings that he did in his first 3 years in the United States, before he went back to England, to France briefly. So here you can see the young Audubon, and they are, first of all, not particularly good, although competent, journeyman, I would say. But he had not yet solved the problem of how to make the birds look alive. So he has them hanging by a string from their beak or one claw with their wings broken. He says in one of his writings, my early drawings were, at best, signs for poulterers. And that's exactly what these drawings
look like. But he's ornitho-obsessive, so to speak, even from the beginning.
He is. I think after the horror of the terror, they moved to a little village downriver from Nantes where there was a country house that the family owned. It's still there. It's being made into a museum now. And right next to this little village of Couran was a wonderful former marsh that was now a forest, where he went with his father on walks, where he went with a physician friend of his father named d'Orbigny, two of whose sons became great famous French naturalists as well, suggesting that d'Orbigny was a marvelous teacher. And it was his papers where they found the new Audubon drawings. So he had ample time in France to learn, to become involved with birds and to learn about birds.
We don't have ample time to fool around with the commercials. We have to hit them more or less on cue.
Sure.
And we're 5 minutes late already, so I pause for those. But when we come back, let's get him married. Let's get him into the family situation. Let's get him launched into his most unusual career.
Sure.
And let's examine how long he worked at it and how little reward there was for a long, long time.
Yes.
All of that to follow as we draw from the excellent new biography, John James Audubon, The Making of an American, by Richard Rhodes. Though I should say, later on we're going to go to some of the other work that Richard Rhodes has done, certainly the next to the last book, which deals with a very different sort of subject, the Einsatzgruppen in World War II, the Hitlerite groups, the SS groups that went east and started killing Jews even before the Wannsee Conference, and managed to dispatch about a million or a million and a
million
half of
and
them.
Million and a half, yes.
Yeah. We'll talk about that and yet other interests that you have pursued in your rather wide-ranging career as a nonfiction writer, though I might add there are also four novels way back there in the dim past as you began to be a professional writer. All of that to follow with Richard Rhodes after this. And we return to our guest, Richard Rhodes, whose most recent book, universally hailed by all the reviewers over the last month or so, is John James Audubon, The Making of an American. I might add, this is also, not only is it superbly written and engaging on every page, rich with wonderful quotations from the letters and from yet other sources, but also it's a very handsome book physically.
Knopf did a beautiful job
really
of designing
did.
It. There's 16 pages of color plates. You have to see Audubon's work to have a sense of how good it was.
Yeah, you couldn't do a book on Audubon without reproducing
exactly.
these plates.
Exactly. And lots of period engravings just to give a sense of this time.
But you know, for many, many years I knew of Audubon's work, of course, but had never seen the full elephant size originals. Explain what that was.
The largest size paper that was made in that day was 29 by 36, 2 feet by 3 feet, almost 3 feet by four feet. Audubon wanted to do all the birds at life size, which is easy enough for your sparrows, but when we're talking about a pelican or a golden eagle, so even with this huge paper, he still had to move the birds and put them in careful positions to get them to fit within the frame. But it was part of his ambition that he show all the birds in their real form.
He was ultimately, in his career, once it really flowered, a self-publisher.
Yes. The tradition for art books in those days was that you sold subscriptions in advance. Nobody had the capital to invest that, but this book took 12 years to produce.
Just as Dr. Johnson sold subscriptions for his dictionary.
Exactly, right. Yeah. And then in this case, they would send out five printed copper-plated, hand-colored plates of these huge sheets in a set called a number, and people would pay for those, and then the next five, and that's the way they had a cash flow. Audubon raised every penny for this work himself, and I estimate it cost him, in modern dollars, about $2.5 million.
One of his customers was King George the Fourth, wasn't
he? Yes, yes.
Yeah, back in England.
And a number of, and the King of France as of 1830. So, yes, no, and he put their names at the top of the list. This was like modern celebrities. Yeah. This was good advertising. But most of them never paid, you know. Daniel Webster was on the list, but he never paid for his subscription.
Really?
Yes, I hope Webster's descendants hear this, you know.
But this is towards the end, or at least at the high point of his career.
Right.
How do we get him from where we were before to there?
So he's on his plantation in Pennsylvania. He's
owned by his father.
Owned by his father. He's 19 or 20 years old. He's quite the swell. He's wearing linen shirts and riding horses and so forth. He could, by the way, fence, sing, play the flute, play the violin. He was dance well enough to teach dancing. He was a very charming fellow.
Good looking too, was he?
Handsome as a movie star.
Yeah.
Next door was a newly arrived English family of great wealth. And they had a daughter, and she was lovely. She was 17, and she was tall and slim and had smoky gray eyes. She was smart. She was well-educated for the day, athletic. They fell in love, of course, and they married after he made his way back to France to get his father's permission. And like so many of that generation of young people around and after 1800, that the historian Joyce Appleby calls the first generation of Americans, they left home. They left their family's traditional careers. They put together with her dowry and the money he had been able to raise a the equipment needed to open a general store, and they moved across the Appalachians along with thousands of other young Americans to settle the Trans-Appalachian West. They opened a general store in Louisville. They stayed there a couple of years. During all this time, while Audubon's trying to become a prosperous businessman, as a hobby, he's working on his birds. And every few years, to make himself improve, he burns all the drawings. So he has to start over. 1810, they decide Louisville isn't producing the kind of returns they hoped it would. They move 500 or 600 miles down the Ohio River to the edge of White Settlement, Henderson, Kentucky, open a store there. Pretty soon they have three stores going. They're buying and selling town real estate. They're really the kind of the fashionable people of town. And just to indicate how vigorous they were, both of them, they used to swim back and forth across the Ohio River for exercise. The Ohio River in those days was half a mile wide.
Mm-hmm.
This goes along well until 1819. Audubon by now has invested the equivalent of $300,000 in a big steam-powered grist and sawmill on the Ohio River. But something happened then that led to his bankruptcy and his great embarrassment and shame. And he's traditionally, by biographers, been accused of neglecting his business for birding. But I discovered it was just the opposite. He had neglected his birding for business. But at this expansionary time in American life, there was a panic and a collapse of the national economy. It came about because the federal government had to put together the gold and silver to finish paying for the Louisiana Purchase. And in order to do that, they called in all the loans to all the new little state banks, which didn't have any specie in their vaults. They called in the loans to all the businessmen. Almost every businessman west of the Appalachians went broke that year. To Audubon, it was a great personal shame, and worse than that, he had to sell everything he owned. It was then that he remembered that he had learned to draw portraits. So he went to work, the only kind of image of yourself you could get in those days, before cameras, before photography, was an oil painting, which was a very expensive business. Audubon offered to do a black chalk portrait to people for $5 a drawing, which would be about $100 today. Soon he had enough business to support himself. Thus he learned that he could make a living as an artist. Then he remembered his experiences with his predecessor, Alexander Wilson, who had published the previous best book on the birds of America, but it left out a lot of birds in the Mississippi Flyway, where Audubon was now living. So he put those two things together and conceived this grand dream. Remember, he's broke. He's living from hand to mouth doing portraits of people. He puts together this grand dream that he will do the ultimate book on the birds of America.
Every bird in America.
Every bird he could identify. He wanted to go all the way to California. He never got there. He never got west of the Rockies. But at least in the end, had some 440 species of birds in the book, which is, of the 700 and some that are in the United States, a pretty good number.
And he develops a new way of doing such work, a way that makes them look far less static than they do in all the previous.
The ornithological tradition up to Audubon's day had been to depict a bird standing on a branch with its wings folded, just basic identification patterns of the kind we have in field guides today.
And we see his birds swooping and feeding their young and
and
attacking other birds or other animals and so
full
on.
Full of the complex and feeling life that Audubon knew birds had, but that certainly was not part of our understanding in this country at the time. Songbirds as well as game birds were food for people in those days. There was not much commercial agriculture yet. Audubon recalled in New Orleans seeing an entire display of owls that had been killed for food. He said the locals used the meat for gumbo. The passenger pigeon was a famous bird, of which there may have been as many as 3 billion in North America at the time of Columbus.
You describe his description of having once seen millions of such passenger pigeons pass through, filling the sky for 3 whole days.
3 days, yes.
Where was that?
That was in Ohio. It was along the Ohio River.
Uh-huh.
These birds were called passengers because they didn't migrate. They just moved around.
Uh-huh.
He said we just called them wild pigeons. But if you think that at the time of Columbus, there were estimated to be 7 billion birds in North America, of which 3 billion were passenger pigeons.
So the skies could darken with the birds.
And they literally did. It was like a river in the sky.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, they're extinct. The last bird died in a Cincinnati zoo in 1913.
You know, it rather brings back memories of the images in Hitchcock's film, The Birds.
Yes. But they were a source of food, and that's why people... Audubon once saw a barge load of passenger pigeons going down the Hudson to the markets of New York. Yeah. So
You know, all the same, it's a little startling. It was a little startling to me to learn that his basic method to get these birds looking so flexible and so alive was to shoot them and then to mount them in his own special way.
But of course, he had no cameras. He had no binoculars. The only way he could draw a bird was to collect a specimen. The problem then was he couldn't keep hanging them by strings, as we talked about these early drawings of his. He one day woke up and realized that the way to do this was to impale some wires into a piece of board, which was gridded so that, as people who know about drawing know, you could transfer the bird onto the drawing page through the grid. The wires would be sharpened at their projecting ends, and onto this, the specimen could be impaled in a position such as flight or walking or whatever that he had previously identified when he studied the bird as alive. And that made it possible for him to break free from this old way of drawing birds and to depict them at their full glory.
He also breaks free, so to speak, of his wife, of that beautiful young English woman who's now growing middle-aged, and he goes off sometimes for months at a time, ultimately for a few years at a time.
He did, and Lucy has often been depicted as the unwilling victim of his ambitions. But in fact, she was an enthusiastic participant in this project. They were a very modern family in a way. She basically said to him, "I'll go to work. I'll teach piano, I'll teach deportment, I'll teach what I can teach, and take care of our two sons while you go out and raise the money to get to England to do the big copperplate engravings that were the ultimate goal of all of this work." She wanted him to do this because she thought it would be a way to recoup the family fortunes, because she thought it would give them increased status in their world, which it did. They ended up having dinner at the White House with Andrew Jackson, hobnobbing with the Dukes and Lords of England. But she also knew how broken he had been by his going broke, how ashamed he had been that he had failed so miserably. And when in fact it was just a national calamity, it was like the Great Depression, but he didn't feel that way. So she wanted him to do this. She certainly sometimes felt the loneliness and the struggle of having to take care of all these things herself. But basically, she did it in good part.
By when is his fame established? By when is his work widely circulated and admired?
You know, it's one of the most amazing events. He went to England in the summer of 1826 with a portfolio full of these magnificent drawings of his. And within 2 months of stepping off the boat in Liverpool, where he knew not a soul but had some letters of introduction, within 2 months he was a rock star. And I'm puzzled about how he did
A
this.
rock star, you say?
He really was. Everybody wanted him to come to dinner. People were lining up to see his exhibitions. He was known all over the country. How did this happen? Well, one minor aspect of it, but an interesting coincidence, is that 6 months before he arrived, The Last of the Mohicans was published in England and was a huge national bestseller. Even, I mean, the Wedgwood Pottery was making plates with Last of the Mohican scenes on the product spinoffs. So suddenly, this man with his unfashionably shoulder-length hair in rough-cut Western clothes, who can do an Indian war whoop or make an owl call, who can play the flute or dance or talk all evening about the wilderness, steps off the boat. It's as if Natty
And with a
Bumppo,
French accent as
and
well.
with a French accent, it's as if Natty Bumppo had just arrived in England. But more deeply, I think this was a world where there were no images except those that were done by hand. The aniline dyes had not yet been discovered, so people's clothing was drab. England was an absolute smog pool of coal smoke in the cities. Audubon could barely bear to live in London because of the air. And he would line a hall with these extraordinary, huge, brightly colored plates, not just of birds, but of the whole wilderness behind the birds. And I think when you walked into it, it would have been like going into an IMAX theater. People were just dazzled with this vision of wilderness that Audubon
And
brought.
they'd pay decent admission fees to
And they
come see
did.
it.
It was one of the ways he raised money for the work.
When does he return to America?
1839, after 12 long years of producing this book, it's now four volumes. They're like huge flagstones. If you've ever seen a set, they're just coffee table sized, but with no room for any other books on the coffee table. It takes two people to turn the pages. And if you ever have the chance, it's such a wonderful experience because it's like watching a slow motion movie to go through these works one by
Well,
one.
there's a fellow named Oppenheimer who's just across the street from us in the Wrigley Building, who is probably one of the leading Audubon dealers in the world.
He
He's got
is
a great
indeed.
gallery. Does he have a full volume there still? I think
I
he had one
don't
once.
know. I don't know. On his website, he lists almost 200 individual plates.
Yeah.
And you can see them in
the
window.
The full-size plates.
Yes, the original Havel. Havel was the name of the engraver who did this work. You know, one of the reasons I think Audubon has faded a little bit in the judgment of art historians is because his work, it's hard to say what was Audubon's. Typically, someone does a painting, he signs the painting, they put a frame about it, and it's up on the wall. But Audubon's idea of the finished work were these copper plate engravings that were then hand-colored by a staff of 50 people in London that were done by Robert Havel, his engraver. So who's the artist? From his point of view, it was a collaborative work. But today on a gallery wall, you will see by Robert Havel Jr. after John James Audubon.
Uh-huh.
So the only originals really are the original watercolors, which are at the New York Historical Society.
Hmm.
And beginning on February 18th, they're going to have an exhibition of 40 of them up for public display. If anyone's going to New York, they should go there and see them.
I imagine you're going to drop in
to
give a lecture.
In that hall full of Audubon.
Of course you will.
Can't wait.
Of course you will. As a matter of fact, tomorrow you'll be speaking in Chicago. I am reliably informed that you've got an occasion at the Newberry Library tomorrow at 6 p.m.
Yes, that's correct.
Sponsored by
the
Seminary Co-op
Seminary
Bookstore.
Co-op, and I'll be signing books, of course, after I talk.
Wonderful. We've had to pause for the usual reasons. When we return, a few more words about Audubon, about the rest of his career, and about how the life unfolded and what became of him and his wife and his family. But then on to yet other works that you've given us in recent years, particularly the most recent book on the Einsatzgruppen. And what's the title of the book?
Masters of Death.
Masters of Death.
Yeah.
And we return directly to Richard Rhodes to talk about those and yet other matters after we pause for this. So John James Audubon comes back loaded with honor and rather well-heeled from England. What does he do with the rest of his life? He still goes out there again to do more birds, doesn't he?
Not much more. He really had covered what was available.
He's done it.
And he really had not made much extra money. He'd broken even and supported his family on the Birds of America. But it was so expensive to produce, there were only 185 copies ever made. What he did when he came back was very canny. He and his sons, who by now were adults, and he trained them as artists and as businessmen, put together a reduced-size version of the Birds of America called the Octavo Edition. And that sold so many copies that they made close to $1 million in modern dollars. They bought a farm on the Manhattan Island between 155th and 166th Street on the Hudson River in Washington Heights, and built a lovely house, Lucy's first house. She moved into her first house to call her own at 55 years of age.
My goodness.
And they had an elk there and a buffalo and the usual, and lots of birds. And he made one more expedition out west because he and a friend of his, a naturalist named John Backman, put together a book on the mammals of North America. And Audubon took an expedition on a steamboat that belonged to the American Fur Company up the Missouri River as far west as its junction with the Yellowstone in what is now far northwestern North Dakota. He came home. By then it was 1843. He slowly slipped into dementia, so that by 1846, he no longer recognized Backman when Backman came to call on him. And Backman wrote a memorable letter where he said, "The body is intact, but the mind is all in ruins."
How old was he at that time?
He died in 1851 at 65 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
So he was in his mid-50s to late 50s. Yeah. It was probably Alzheimer's, although that disease had not been named
That's
yet.
That's an early Alzheimer's, early onset.
Yes, yes. So he faded away. Lucy lived on to be 84 before she died. Unfortunately, some of the investments the sons made after their father died didn't work out, and they had to sell their farm and sell their house. Lucy ended up going back to teach school at the age of 70, living with relatives. So it was a kind of sad ending. Both of the boys died relatively young as well from accident and pneumonia. So sad ending. Someone told me once that if you write a biography and tell the whole life, it's always a tragedy because the person dies at the end. And that, of course, happened here. But it was a glorious life, and it was a glorious example of how America became America. The terms that we use to describe the American character were really invented in the course of this generation, living out its life.
The terms we use, what do you mean by
Well, I
that?
mean the idea that the American character is optimistic, that it's brash and bold, that it's entrepreneurial, that it's individualistic. These are all qualities that applied to John James Audubon and to tens of thousands of his peers. He was a unique human being, but he was also a very characteristic American of his day.
What a contrast between this book of yours and the very last that you've done,
Yes.
that is the penultimate one, if this is the ultimate, though it's not the ultimate in your career. You've got others still coming, I know. But to study the Einsatzgruppen, explain what they were and what led you to them.
The Einsatzgruppen were a group of about 3,000 elite SS men who volunteered to follow the Wehrmacht into Poland and Russia with Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of the Soviet Union in June 41, supposedly to pacify the civilians after the army passed through the occupied territories, as it were. In fact, their purpose was to start the slaughter of the Jews. At that point, no one had thought of the idea of a death camp with an industrialized killing system. The idea was, which we're now familiar with from ethnic cleansing, you take the people out to the edge of town where someone has dug a ditch for you, you line them up on the edge of the ditch and you shoot them, and then you cover up the bodies.
Or you have them dig their own ditches and then stand by the ditch as you shoot them and then cover them up, and then you bring out the next group to dig their own grave
Yes,
and then shoot them
yes.
down, and so on.
I was fascinated with this story for several reasons. One, if you look through the traditional histories of the Holocaust, you will find at best a chapter on the Einsatzgruppen. They're often described as having been wild troops who were not following rules, and none of that was true. This was a very carefully planned operation. It was run by Reinhard Heydrich, the second in command of the SS, and a notorious figure. In addition, I've always been offended by the notion that somehow science was responsible for the death camps, as if you were to blame what has been perhaps the most creative force in Western society for the last 500 years for the most terrible, terrible genocide of the last 500 years. It didn't make sense to me. There's nothing scientific about a gas chamber or a cremation oven. Their standard equipment for industrialized killing. We knew how to do this. Chicago perfected these techniques with the slaughterhouses here. The Einsatzgruppen had a different purpose, and this is what fascinated me. I had just written a book, which you and I talked about on a previous appearance here, about the studies of an American criminologist named Lonnie Athens, who interviewed several hundred violent criminals in the United States and identified a sort of standard process that people go through to become violent. And I wanted to see if the Einsatzgruppen elite and the many policemen, the ordinary men who were brought in to back them up and help them, because in the end there were 30 or 40,000 people doing this killing.
Yeah, they brought in what they called Ordnungsbataillonen,
Yes.
Which are really military police.
Right, as well as just traffic police who'd been drafted and so forth. And these men participated in the killing to various degrees. I wanted to see if the model that Dr. Athens had developed from interviewing American violent criminals would also apply to the development of this violence in these very different people in this very different
Well, let
place.
us quickly review the Athens model.
Athens found that in 100% of the people he studied, what they all had in common irreducibly that led to their violence was that they were brutalized. Usually in childhood, usually in the family, but sometimes in the streets and sometimes in the military and sometimes even as adults. That they then at some point were also violently coached, told that their way to survive in the world was to use violence. Don't let that bully pick on you. I want you to go back there and bring me two of that bully's teeth, or don't come home at all, or I'll beat you up. That's the kind of thing, that's violent coaching. When they get enough brutalization, typically at the age of 8 or 9 for boys in the American criminal community, they make a decision that they're going to try violence defensively against people who are attacking them or threatening them, and thereby solve the problem of being a victim.
What then would you predict for somebody who, as a young boy, suddenly confronted the suicide of his mother and then lived shortly thereafter with a stepmother who was constantly violent against him? beat him and in many ways persecuted him, finally driving him out of the home mm-hmm. into essentially an orphan's home.
Mm-hmm.
What would you expect to come from such a young fellow when he grew older and became mature?
You might well expect, if you thought that only the brutalization was necessary to the process, for that person to become violent.
Mm-hmm.
But of course I didn't. You're describing my childhood.
As you recounted in an autobiographical work.
It's called A Hole in the World, which
yeah.
is still in print and paperback. And that's been one of the mysteries of psychology, as I'm sure you know. Why do some abused children mm-hmm. grow up to be violent, others don't?
Were you in your own life pattern after that coached in the ways of violence, would you say?
I don't remember being coached. Athens says I must have been.
But you've discussed this with Athens.
But the
himself.
Point is, if at a crucial turning point when these young people are deciding that violence might solve their
mm-hmm.
problems,
yeah.
if at that point you have other models to guide you, other people to guide you, then you don't necessarily choose the violent route. The violent route has a major disadvantage. You mm-hmm. risk your life when you decide to fight back when somebody is attacking you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not an easy decision to make. But if that's the only one you know, then that's the one you probably
What other models were, in fact, available in the life of young Richard Rhodes?
Other models were, because I went to the boys' home where violence was strictly enjoined.
Uh-huh.
It simply was not tolerated.
So you were saved by the boys' home.
And where there were wonderful adults uh-huh. teaching us and taking care of us, who gave us an infinite number of ways to be empowered. In 4-H and in FFA and in scouting and in church, all those things. So I found other routes rather than violence.
Yeah. With regard to the Einsatzkommando groups and the routine killing that they'd done, and for that matter, with regard then to the people who staffed the extermination camps once they were erected largely in Poland, Auschwitz and Birkenau and Treblinka and so on, there is a counter-hypothesis, as you know. It's the one formulated by Hannah Arendt. To be sure,
yes.
She formulates it with regard to Adolf Eichmann
right.
particularly, but she really views it as applicable generally. That is to say, well, it's given in the subtitle of her book. Eichmann in Jerusalem is the title. The subtitle is The Banality
yes.
of Evil. The bureaucratization of murder makes quite ordinary people capable
but
of following
fact,
those orders.
But in fact, Athens' model makes it clear that you don't make violent people by putting them at a desk and giving them a typewriter or the equivalent. In fact, these SS men in the Einsatzgruppen had been through the war. They had been through the 20s when the Freikorps, the guerrilla forces, killed mm-hmm. routinely as part of their operations. Military training matches Athens' model. If you stop at what Athens calls stage 3, which is defensive violence, soldiers are trained through a sort of re-identification process in brutal boot camp and then coached to be violent and then rewarded when they're successfully using violence. They stop at stage 3, which is defensive violence. They are trained and the code of honor is you only kill or attack people who are threatening you or your people. Right? The enemy soldier, by definition, is threatening your life.
Reminds you of the great line by George Patton. Your job is to kill the bastard who's trying to kill you.
That's right. Where we have problems in the military and police forces and, of course, in violent criminals, is that some go on through the fourth stage, which is deciding that if violence works so well defensively, then why not also use it offensively against people who aren't threatening you? Now, the Einsatzgruppen were first ordered only to kill Jewish men of military age,
mm-hmm.
not women and children. They were told, these are threatening people, these are dangerous, you must kill them. So that was not so difficult. They were able to perceive them to be enemy combatants, just like soldiers.
Yeah.
But then in midsummer, when Hitler decided he was going to finish off Russia by Christmas, the order went out through Himmler to kill the women and the children and the babies as well. And then Himmler suddenly had a problem. Men were having breakdowns, they were becoming drunks, and most threatening at all from Himmler's point of view, they were beginning to enjoy the violence. And that he couldn't bear. So he observed one of these Einsatzgruppen slaughters and turned to his general and said, we've got to find another way to do this. And the death camps emerged from that problem.
Mm.
The death camps' purpose was to reduce the trauma to the perpetrators. At places like Treblinka, there were only 75 SS men. The rest were all prisoners of war, mm-hmm. the Jews themselves. They were sort of places where death could be industrialized, and the people who were doing the suffering had to do the killing too.
What do you make, though, how do you fit in Goldhagen's thesis, as given in his book, Hitler's Willing Executioners, who says a necessary, if not sufficient, condition for the Holocaust to have happened was that most Germans shared a disdain for and an anger against the Jews.
Well, but of course that was true all over Europe, and it was only the Germans who carried out this genocide. Not only the Germans, of course, the Romanians had their part in it, as did other countries too.
Various Balts and,
yes,
and Ukrainians helped out,
right,
in the camps, certainly.
Nevertheless, I think that collective guilt doesn't make sense to me. It doesn't make sense in terms of the developmental process of human beings. Collective violence makes sense, of course. Then you have the more complicated question of how a whole group could behave violently.
Apart from your work on Audubon, much of your writing has been concerned with violence,
yes,
in one form or another.
From my childhood.
From your childhood. Right. Your childhood generated that interest,
yes,
obviously. Your Pulitzer Prize-winning book about the making of the atom bomb obviously relates to,
right,
a form of violence which still threatens us to this day.
It does.
We are due to pause once again. When we return, I want to go to those two or three earlier books of yours focused on the making of the bomb, and I know the one you're working on currently, which is the continuing danger of,
right,
nuclear
the
weapons.
The last 20 years.
We will be directly back to Richard Rhodes after this. You've done so much, Richard Rhodes, that it is the challenge for the interviewer to try to find a way to segue from one batch of work to another. But there is continuity between them.
There
and
is.
It was, again, your concern with and your deep investment in attempting to understand the sources and the uses of violence,
yes,
that must have led you to the atom bomb itself.
It was. You know, I was 8 years old in 1945.
Mm-hmm.
All of my childhood up to then had been the Second World War. And I remember at 8 opening Life magazine to a photograph of the Hiroshima mushroom cloud and being told this had stopped the war and thinking, my Lord, what could that be? And that was when I started to be interested in science. So it's a very old connection. And that paradox, of course, that, yeah, the atomic bombs did or did not end the war, but at least the war stopped then. And it had been a terrible war, the worst war in human history. So,
what did you turn up in the doing of that book? That was the book that got you the Pulitzer Prize.
It was,
wasn't it?
Yes. Well, I had thought, I started that book in 1979. That was the time when the arms race looked as if it was going out of control between us and the Soviet Union. A lot of people were marching in the streets, and I didn't think that would be the best use of my time. But it seemed to me that if I went back to the beginning and understood how it all began, there must have been some other paths to follow besides the terrible paths that we all chose of arms races and fear. And there were other paths, and the other path was really the idea that this dilemma of these weapons that were so terribly portable and destructive would, in the course of time, lead countries to realize that they were a common danger to everyone in the world. And then, just as if it were a pandemic of some terrible disease, all the nations would see that they had a practical reason to sit down and negotiate some end to it all. We're not there yet, but we've made quite a bit of progress over the years, particularly with the end of the Soviet Union, all the arms control treaties that were developed over the years, most particularly the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. I recently interviewed two scientists in Sweden who worked on the Swedish atomic bomb. Most people have
never heard
of the Swedish atomic bomb.
Well, they have the capability, but they haven't made
it. They started working
on
a bomb in 1946, and they certainly got far enough along, as one of them told me, to separate about 300 grams of plutonium, and they certainly had their designs all worked out. But then the opportunity to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty in 1968 came along, and they realized, first of all, that if now that the Soviet Union had hydrogen bombs, their little atomic bombs weren't going to be any good to them anyway. Two hydrogen bombs in Sweden wouldn't be there anymore. So they gave up their program, and they signed the treaty. And the skills and knowledge that they acquired have been helpful to them, because they know when somebody's cheating. They were able to convince,
yeah,
the South Africans to
shut
down their
program. I
got to
say, most people don't remember that South Africa actually produced a bomb or two.
South Africa had 6 bombs, and the 7th one was,
yeah,
in the works, yes.
And then they decided to dismantle those.
They signed the treaty as well. So this treaty was a very important step toward eliminating nuclear weapons.
But North Korea hasn't signed such a treaty.
Well, actually, they did, and then they backed out of
it. They backed out of
it.
I doubt that Iran ever signed such a treaty.
No. No, there are only 3 countries right now, Iran, Israel, and I'm sorry, I've forgotten the other, but that actually are not signatories. India.
Nor has Al-Qaeda signed that treaty.
No, and that's a real problem, because deterrence works if you have a home address.
Exactly.
Then our threat can block their threat. But it's a little more difficult when...
But the possibility of a terrorist use of nuclear weapons...
The question really...
...haunts the present time.
It does. And one of the things that I'm focusing on in this new book is something that was first characterized by Curtis LeMay back after the Second World War, mm-hmm. when he gave a talk where he said the bombers always get through. He had realized that if you think of delivery systems armed with nuclear weapons, that meant that there was, in a way, no defense. He dreamed of preemptive war against the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. which we came very close to doing in 1954. Eisenhower vetoed the idea and thought it was reprehensible to think about a Pearl Harbor against the Soviet Union. But this central problem has led the way down through the years to people worrying about these issues. What the Bush administration clearly realized after 9/11 was two things, not just one. One, there were terrorists who were capable of getting inside the country and attacking us from within. But two, what if they had had a nuclear weapon? And that's why I think the Bush answer to this dilemma of nuclear weapons was preemptive war. Unfortunately, they didn't have any weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which Hans Blix could have told him and did tell him, but he wasn't prepared to believe it. But that's what Iran is about right now. Most of all, they're concerned about a terrorist atomic mm-hmm. bomb, and it's all too plausible.
I'm glad you mentioned Iran, because a while ago, not only a few months ago, Graham mm-hmm. Allison of the Kennedy Center at Harvard,
yes,
a former Assistant Secretary of Defense, very much concerned with nuclear proliferation. Allison, as you know, has done a major book.
He's done a book, yes, absolutely.
I've read it. He was here, and we chatted about it. And here is a 3-minute or so clip from Graham Allison discussing this very threat. What do you do with Iran?
Well, in the Iranian case, as opposed to the current policy which we have, which is not clear what we want, we first get clear what we want. And I would say there's a lot of things I would like to have in Iran, but the one thing that I have to have is no nuclear weapons in Iran. Every possibility for life for the U.S., for Israel, for oil, with a nuclear-armed Iran is not good. So I'm going to just focus on one thing that I want from Iran, no nuclear weapons. So then I assemble all the carrots that I can imagine, all whole bundleful, and also the sticks that I need, the arsenal sticks.
Yesterday, the president made a statement pointed towards Iran, saying that we hold all options open, which is a way of saying, if necessary, we'll bomb your reactors.
Well, some people would have some reservations about that. I would say that in the sticks category, in my proposal, we have to be able to pose a credible military threat to these facilities. And it could be by us or it could be by Israel. Israel has said repeatedly that an Iran that with nuclear weapons is across its red line. And the Israeli defense minister said as recently as day before yesterday that Israel would itself take military action before this came into being. So it, as a way of concentrating their mind, I don't want to attack them, but I don't mind persuading them. In terms of the carrots, here's what the deal would look like. What would Iran get? Iran would get the right to have a civilian nuclear power plant, the one that's being built by the Russians at Bushehr, and even to buy more if they want to. Secondly, they'd have an international guarantee of fuel for this reactor or any future reactors at half the price of what they could produce it. So they say they're wanting this this enrichment facility in Iran in order to have fuel because they're worried about having fuel for their nuclear reactor. Nope. International guarantee, you get it at half the price it would cost you to make it, so it can't have any economic incentive. And the spent fuel, which would otherwise be a waste problem for you, will go back to Russia, where it's going to be stored for Iran. You're not going to have it in order to get the plutonium out of it either. You would also get additional trade and investments from Europe, which is eager to provide those, and you would get an assurance here, now the very important, you'd get an assurance from the U.S. publicly that we will not attack you in order to try to change your regime. Now, what would you give up for Iran? You would give up the completion of these facilities for enriching uranium and reprocessing plutonium. So you would not be able to make uranium and you would not be able to make plutonium. And if you can't make uranium and plutonium, you can't make a bomb. So we would get a non-nuclear Iran, not a good Iran. It would still be a mullocracy. They would still be nasty people that we don't like. We would have to wait for their regime to change at some point. But we wouldn't attack them, but they wouldn't have nuclear weapons.
But they could still sneak some fissionable material to Al-Qaeda and similar outfits.
This prevents them ever producing any. Now, they might buy some out of some other place and do some other transfer. That's another problem. But this would prevent them ever producing any, because they're now within months of completing these factories. Once those factories are running, there's no further bright policeable line between them and nuclear bombs.
What do you think of that?
You know, I think part of that makes sense to me, and part of it leaves me puzzled.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I've never been able to imagine any country, certainly a country that only has a little bit of fissionable material, giving it away to anybody, much less to a group that they don't have control over. And countries that have a lot of it aren't likely to do it either, actually. So that's not a very plausible scenario. You know, Saddam Hussein couldn't buy, beg, borrow, or steal 25 kilograms of uranium or 5 kilograms of plutonium from Russia or anywhere else in the world with all of his resources. It doesn't seem likely to me that that's a viable scenario. That's one of the reasons I think a terrorist bomb is at least unlikely, even though always possible. But the way we've worked with other countries in the past that has been successful, North-South Korea, Taiwan, Argentina, Brazil, and several other countries besides that were on the path toward developing nuclear weapons was to give them security guarantees, as Allison just said, suggested we might do for Iran as well. Why then all the threatening? Simply because we don't like the regime? This really is more important than whether we like the regime or not. It's clear, I think, that Iran has been very slowly moving toward a nuclear capability for at least the last 10 years.
And
they've never been rushed about it.
And in the 2 or 3 months since we recorded that program with Graham Allison, they have more vociferously announced they're going forward make nuclear weapons. And the grand Ayatollah Khatami, only the other day, speaking to a great assembly of military officers in Iran, announced that our eternal purpose is the destruction of Israel and the United States.
And yet at the same time, I don't think they formally acknowledge that they're working on nuclear weapons. They still claim this program is peaceful. Nevertheless, the fact is they've been moving in that direction quietly. If they've accelerated recently, I think it's pretty clear why. The president announced that there was an axis of evil. He had invaded one of the three countries on his list. The other two countries, understandably, I think, take him seriously.
And at the other end of the axis of evil, the North Koreans announced just the other day, we now have a number of nuclear weapons on our missiles.
No, they do not have number of nuclear weapons on their missiles.
Well, but they have missiles.
They have missiles, but the third stage of that missile that they tested that reached out supposedly as far as Alaska weighed less than 100 pounds. Mm-hmm. It was basically a calculator and a watch. I mean, it was not even remotely something that could carry a nuclear weapon. It didn't have any guidance system. So they don't really have a missile. And if they have a bomb, it's very likely closer to a World War II design than one of our modern small ones.
It is obvious that for the book you're now working on, you're studying all of this.
Yes, I am. Absolutely.
And looking at what's being done in all of the countries that are potentially capable of generating nuclear weapons.
And I think that there's some really promising discoveries. At least 25 countries around the world could go nuclear in a matter of months today.
And choose not to,
because it is not to their advantage.
Yeah.
They signed a treaty that they accept and are solemn about. This is the approach that I think in the long run. The fact is, one of the reasons the Iranians want nuclear weapons are like India, because they feel that they've always been an oppressed colonial state, and they want this as a way of announcing that they're in control of their destiny.
Now, you know, Allison starts his book with something far more frightening even than the Iranian scenario. He starts literally in the first few paragraphs with the guess that there are now in the United States in operation a number of Al-Qaeda groups who are ready to be mobilized, who will follow orders, and who may very well have, or will shortly be supplied with, may shortly be supplied with, fissionable material purchased from renegade or maverick Soviet, former Soviet generals who are handling some of those loose nukes that are still lying around.
You know,
which they might then use in America, if not for a great nuclear bomb that you send in with a missile, they might all the same more easily design radioactive radiation.
But for that,
weapons.
They don't need fissionable material.
You don't even need fissionable material for that.
Just
or you might get one which you can explode within at the center of a city, which is at least an old-fashioned atom bomb, if not a hydrogen bomb.
I don't think it's so easy to do these things. You know,
I don't know how easy
there
it
was a study that was done at Livermore in the 1970s where they sent two young recent graduate physicists to the task of designing an atomic bomb with no access to the classified literature. It took them 3 years. And the design they came up with would work. But one of the things that the people studying these two men discovered is that most of the amateur attempts to design a bomb inevitably put too much fissionable material in the bomb, which means it's going to blow up in the basement before it's ever delivered to the target. It's not such an easy thing to do. I don't think we should imagine people with turbans running around putting bombs together.
What about that Russian material? Is there any on the black market, so to speak?
You know, the most that's been turned up has been, I think, less than half a kilogram of a fissionable piece of uranium. The Russians have more reason to be worried about this question than we do because they're surrounded by countries that don't wish them well, where they had materials. And one of the things the Russians did, because the whole country was a police state, because there were barbed wire borders around the whole country, they sent the stuff all over the country. Every institute that wanted to work with some material got some. Now they're having... We've spent close to $1 billion helping them start accounting for every last bit of that material. There's a batch of material out there that the United States sent around the world back in the 50s. We gave reactors fueled with weapons-grade uranium to a lot of countries, including Iraq. And in the last days before the first Iraq war, Saddam's people were trying to make a bomb out of that American U-235. They didn't succeed. They were about 3 months short, they said.
So where do we stand? I think back to John Kennedy's great speech, or was it at a press conference, where he said the genie is out of the bottle and you can't get it back in. Can we, in fact, contain that genie, the nuclear genie?
You know, what we can do, I think, and this is the equivalent of abolition, in a world where there's more transparency than there is today, which we're moving to rapidly, meaning where you can keep track of the materials that are out there, in such a world, you could start lengthening the delivery time between takeoff and target of your missiles and your bombs. This is something Sam Nunn was talking about recently, and it connects with something I've been thinking through, too. Back during the bomber days, it took maybe 20 hours to deliver a nuclear warhead to Russia, to the Soviet Union. Then we got missiles, and now we're down to half an hour or less. Well, of course, that shortens all the time you need to maybe find some alternative to destroying a country and destroying yourself. If we can delay delivery times progressively until it's 3 months, I can imagine a world where you have deterrence and it takes 3 months to get a bomb over. So then if some other country and the bombs are gone, all you have is the warehouses, the fissionable material, and the people who know how to make the bombs. Then if someone starts to cheat, all the other countries in the world can start dealing with that, first perhaps by diplomacy, then by military action with conventional weapons. And if all else fails, you start making bombs too, and you're just back to where we are now.
But Murphy's Law also obtains, if anything can go wrong, it will. And the detection equipment, the early warning systems, may very well malfunction. We've got to stop this.
That's why you have to have multiple systems, which we already do.
Well, but still. We're going to stop for some commercials, and then I want to determine whether we have available, and I'm asking this of my friends in the booth, whether we have available the clip of the discussion with Gates, the former director of the CIA, in which he talks about a near exchange of nuclear blows based upon false information.
Yes, right.
We'll come directly back after this. And we return to our old friend and to the distinguished American writer, Richard Rhodes. We were talking earlier about his new book, John James Audubon, The Making of an American. That's published by Alfred Knopf and Company. But inevitably, we've wandered back into the terrain covered by some of your earlier books, but also by the book that you're incubating at the moment. Your next book will be on the whole set of issues that we've been discussing, or at least briefly touching upon.
Yes.
I promised you another clip. This was only a sudden impulse on my part. I must say, this is probably the clip from a former program that I've played most often since that particular conversation occurred. And it has to do with the question of accidental slippage into nuclear war. Robert Gates, former director of the CIA, remembering here his earlier days as somebody on the staff of the National Security Council, when the National Security Advisor was Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Yes.
Here's the excerpt.
Was there ever on either side a serious apprehension that we might be on the brink of a nuclear exchange?
There were three occasions after the Cuban Missile Crisis when we may have come closer than the publics knew at the time, and in a couple of cases, the governments themselves may have known. The first was in the Yom Kippur War, when the Soviets alerted seven divisions of their airborne troops to go to the Middle East to help the Arabs, and President Nixon put all of our strategic forces on a state of heightened alert. The Soviets then did the same, and that one eventually, actually rather quickly, de-escalated so that there was a great concern about a miscalculation at that time, and both sides were watching very closely. There was also a feeling in this country that President Nixon might have been risking a miscalculation, a war in effect, to try and alleviate some of his domestic political concerns. And there was even a story at the time that Secretary of Defense Jim Schlesinger had issued an order to the military services that no directive from Nixon was to be obeyed unless it came through him.
Was that story true? I remember it.
Well, I don't know. It has been attributed to the White House. I think Schlesinger may have a different view about whether it really happened.
Nixon was in the Watergate soup by then.
That's right. This was October of 73. So, and it really began, Watergate, I think, began to really unravel in the early spring of 73.
That was one such danger point. There were two others.
The second occurred during the Carter administration, and I discuss it in the book, but in essence, in 78 or 79, in the middle of the night one night, Brzezinski got a call from his military assistant at home telling him that the military assistant had been informed by the National Military Command Center that the Soviets had launched 220 warheads at the United States. Brzezinski, knowing that the president's window of decision was 4 to 6 minutes before it would be too late, decided he had to take an extra minute or two to try and determine whether this was true or not. He asked his military assistant to confirm that the Strategic Air Command had launched or was launching its bombers and that the appropriate measures were taken to alert U.S. forces. His assistant called back a minute later and he said, indeed, the first report had been mistaken. There were not 220 nuclear warheads launched against the United States. There were instead 2,200. It was an all-out attack, or it appeared to be an all-out attack.
My God.
Brzezinski later told me he didn't even waken his wife, sleeping there beside him. He figured that the world was coming to an end, and he had about another minute before he called the president. And just before he picked up the phone to call President Carter and tell him what he thought was happening, or what appeared to be happening, he got a third call from his assistant, who said that the space-based sensors were not picking up launches from the Soviet Union.
Was this the famous flight of ducks?
No, this one was an error at the North American Air Defense Command, or at the Strategic Air Command, where an exercise tape had been put into the computer by mistake. And fortunately, because none of the other sensors validated a launch against the United States, nothing happened. The third event happened in 1983, and ironically, the United States didn't even know it had happened. As you probably remember, 1983 was a year of huge tension in the relationship. The United States began to deploy its intermediate nuclear forces to Europe, the ground-launched cruise missiles, Pershing 2s, and so on. All of the arms control agreements were arms control negotiations were suspended for the first time since 1969.
And Ronald Reagan's getting very aggressive. He makes his evil empire speech.
He makes the evil empire
speech. And he announces
SDI,
the Strategic
Defense Initiative.
The
Soviets shoot down the Korean airliner, 007.
Right. Yeah.
The American military attaché, or one of our military liaison officials in Germany, Major Arthur Nicholson, is shot and killed by the Soviets, who stand by and watch him bleed to death. In other words, there's just one event after another that year that builds tension, and you are in the midst of a gigantic military buildup in the United States against the backdrop of Reagan's rhetoric.
In the Acheson phrase, it's eyeball to eyeball.
Absolutely, and both sides are very wary of one another. It really is, I think, the most dangerous year of the latter half of the Cold War.
Well, there you have it. As I say, that's one of my favorite clips. I've played it often on this program. It seems to me it does really evoke the relevance of Murphy's Law. If anything can go wrong, sooner or later, it will.
These are, I think, the best possible arguments for extending and delaying launch times until you have a 3-month window instead of poor Carter's 6-minute window. If we really could keep track of all the materials, which I think is possible. One of the people I'm going to interview for this book is the vice president at FedEx, who keeps track of all the packages. I mean, they've developed some extraordinary technologies for making sure they know where every package is that I'm sure could be adapted. In any case, if the world can get to the point where we've all backed away enough to become the kind of virtual nuclear powers that 25 countries are today, like Australia and Canada and Sweden and Switzerland and Japan and Belgium and so forth.
Virtual in the sense that they can fabricate bombs if they need them.
Any one of those countries could have a nuclear arsenal within 3 months.
Yeah.
Easily. Japan probably even more rapidly than that. In that, if every country in the world were a virtual nuclear power, if it chose to be, then we would be in a position to have some time to check for the mistakes, to deal with possible cheaters, and if worse came to worse, to reconstitute some portion of our arsenal and just return us to the hair-trigger deterrence we live in today. I think it's a wonderful idea. The Bush administration's decision to make preventive war their solution to this problem is fraught with peril, as I think we've already seen. For one thing, it seems to be driving two of the three countries Bush pointed his finger at to develop their nuclear capability as a defense against that threat.
Of course, the ultimate guarantee against nuclear war is something that we used to dream of, but no one even ever mentions it as a serious possibility anymore. That is, quote, total nuclear disarmament.
But in a way, that's what I'm proposing. And that really, I think, goes back again to the beginning. You can't uninvent nuclear weapons. What happened in 1938 when fission was discovered in Nazi Germany by two radiochemists was not simply some guys made a decision that they'd do something. It was a new piece of knowledge about the natural world. And that, as scientific discoveries always do, changed everything in the course of time.
We are due for another batch of commercials, and it's also time to invite telephone calls. What do you want to call us about? Well, we've talked about three or four main topics tonight, to begin with, surely, the wonderful biography of John James Audubon. And we've talked about the roots and sort of the psychological basis of violence as
yes.
such, whether in the rearing of individual children or whether in the undertakings of such groups as the Nazi Einsatzkommando units. And we, I suppose, in continued examination of violence, we've turned to the question of nuclear war and continuing nuclear threats. And we are open for all questions relating to any or all of those topics, or yet others that you think appropriate, and somehow, on a tangential basis at least, relevant to the general tone of this discussion. Therefore, 591-7200 is the number, and get your calls in quickly. We'll get to you in just a few minutes. 591-7200. If you're listening on the internet at some greater distance and would rather reach us via email, the email address extension720@tribune.com. We'll be on to your contributions right after these words. And directly back to Richard Rhodes And on to your calls and or emails to him and for him. 591-7200 is the number. One or two lines available on the phones. If you've been trying to get through, try again, and somebody will get through. And here is the first. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Every time I hear people talk about nuclear capacity, they seem to talk about India, Pakistan, now Iran, Iraq, and, of course, North Korea. And these are considered to be rogue nations, even though I'm not sure if India and Pakistan are still considered to be rogue nations.
Which one of those two are you from?
I am from India.
That's what I thought.
Okay. My question is, are we, let's say if China developed nuclear capacity or Luxembourg developed nuclear capacity, are we as worried about those nations as nuclear nations, or are we just worried about the rogue nations? That's question number one. Question number two is, what happens, does the rest of the world say, does Europe look at America and say, is it possible they're going to use a preemptive after something with its nuclear arsenal? Does Europe ever look at us like that at all?
No, I don't think Europe does. And it's true that the United States has looked the other way when countries that are allied with the United States have developed nuclear capacity. In fact, we helped the British. We didn't help the French. We've always been sort of at odds with the French. China was helped by the Soviet Union back when it developed the nuclear capability, which it has, it probably has 400 nuclear weapons today. In fact, the real problem, I think, is in constantly looking at these so-called rogue nations is the other countries of the world forbore from developing nuclear weapons and signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty with the understanding that the five principal powers, meaning the United States, Britain, France, China, and the Soviet Union, would work hard to reduce and eventually get rid of their nuclear weapons. And there's been precious little of that. There were a lot of weapons dismantled after the end of the Soviet Union. All of our tactical nuclear weapons have basically been taken apart and put away, as have the Soviets. But we still have 10,000. The Soviets still have 15,000. So we haven't shown the kind of good faith that was part of this agreement with all these other countries. And I think in the long run, that could be the destruction of the treaty.
It's interesting in the formulation that this lady gave, that in the country opposite her own home country, that is in Pakistan, you have somebody, A.Q. Khan, was that the middle initial?
Yes.
Who really represents not necessarily a rogue nation, but possibly a rogue operation within the elite of that nation.
And who clearly helped the North Koreans work toward their nuclear arsenal in exchange for their missile technology. Who sent not only centrifuges and other technology to Libya and probably to Iran, but he actually, as a kind of an extra, threw in an old Chinese atomic bomb design, which is absolutely extraordinary when you think about it.
And you think he was just acting on the basis of his own idiosyncratic impulses, or was he being used to put forward a sort of a back-channel policy?
You know, that's, of course, the big question. And he's been kept under house arrest, and Musharraf has not allowed the West to interview him. But he's been pardoned, so he's clear in that sense. It was a combination, evidently, of a desire for wealth, and he made a great deal of money, a kind of an increasingly religious-based idea that Islam needs the bomb, and he was happy to disperse it in that sense. But the real question hasn't been answered because we haven't been able to question the man.
Well, that's just it. You see, our thanks to the caller. That's where what I continue to worry about. And that's, again, where Murphy's Law becomes relevant.
Yes.
It becomes relevant because of the unpredictable and uncontrollable actions of certain centrally placed individuals.
And again, I think that's why you have to imagine a world where there's a great deal more transparency, by which I mean capability for tracking fissionable materials and the machines that make them, than we have now. But we have a lot already. We have seismic systems. We have, of course, our entire range of satellite systems. We would need more yet. You can only imagine dismantling all these nuclear arsenals in a world where you know where everybody else is. Otherwise, you get to the last bomb problem.
Here's an interesting email from one of our regular listeners, I think. I'm enjoying tonight's program as much as I've enjoyed your guest's books. But I wonder what his response would be to the late General Alexander Lebed's claim that a number of so-called suitcase nukes went missing from the Soviet arsenal at the time of the Soviet Union's collapse. Is it possible that they made their way to North Korea, for example? Or was General Lebed simply stating his opinion rather than true facts? He expressed the fear that such weapons would fall into the hands of international terrorists.
You know, the least critical mass for a nuclear weapon is something like 5 kilograms, and that's plutonium. And the only way you can set off plutonium is with a very complicated chemical implosion system. Uranium critical mass is more like 70 pounds. The smallest U.S. nuclear weapon ever designed weighed 100 pounds. The suitcase arsenal, can you imagine, can anyone imagine that the Soviet Union and Russia would sit idly by having lost 50 nuclear weapons with Chechen rebels on one border and so on and so forth around the country of Russia? I think Lebed.
Well, they may not be sitting by idly. They may be going crazy with the threat.
I think Lebed.
But they're not telling us.
No, I don't think so. In fact, that we cooperate with them, they with us. It's just not credible, the story that Lebed told.
Uh-huh.
Of even the idea that you can build a nuclear weapon that you can carry around in a little briefcase is not very credible, except for a power like the United States or the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's reassuring.
Yes.
On the basis of that reassurance, we'll take some reassuring messages from yet other sources and then return to your calls and email to Richard Rhodes. The phone number 591-7200. Some lines are available again. And the email, of course, has infinite capacity. That address is extension 720 at tribune.com with an interesting email and reads as follows. You mentioned that you had never seen the elephant drawings by Audubon. Now, you, of course, have seen them.
Yes.
And did I say I hadn't seen them? I think I may have seen one or two, but not the full volumes, obviously.
They're in the windows of Mr. Oppenheimer's establishment.
Exactly so, and I see them over there.
Yes.
But going on with this interesting email, Northwestern's main library has two or three bound volumes, which it displays on a rotating basis. I was there for a meeting and stopped dead in my tracks when I saw the drawing and knew instantly who had done the work. The young lady who was escorting me had no idea who he was or what she had the privilege of seeing on a regular basis. God help us all! Exclamation point. Is Audubon known and appreciated by younger Americans?
I'm afraid not. I've had several clerks in bookstores ask me, looking at my book, is it a history of the Audubon Society?
Uh-huh.
And I suppose in a certain poetic sense it is, but... No, I think Audubon is not as well known as he might, even though half the streets in America seem to be named after him.
Do they?
Well, almost every town has an Audubon Street. New Orleans has dozens of Audubon things.
Interesting.
Poor man was down and out in New Orleans for 5 years eating moldy cheese.
Uh-huh.
But
yes, the wonderful passage about the maggots jumping out of the cheese.
Yes, their entertainment that evening, seeing how high they could jump.
Yeah.
Right.
But I'm amazed to hear that Audubon is forgotten by large portions of living Americans.
Yes, well.
But then I suppose lots of other important people in our history and in our artistic achievements are forgotten as well.
It's a generation that has grown up on television
instead of
reading books.
And they don't look at pictures?
They've learned all sorts of interesting things, but they haven't learned necessarily the things that you and I learned growing up. Yeah. They do look at pictures, but I'm not sure they worry about who drew them.
Mm-hmm.
Audubon has fallen to the wayside, I think, because it's so hard to access his work. It's not two or three volumes, it's actually 4 volumes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you cut them up and put the drawings up on the wall, then you can see them, but you can't see them in a sequence, which is the way he bound them.
I've always thought that the French had it wrong. It's not plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. It's plus ça change, plus ça change. The more it changes, the more it changes.
Yes.
And you can't reverse it.
And one of the great things that happened in 2000 was that an Audubon set was sold to the Emir of Qatar for $8.8 million, which means no more sets are going to be broken up because the set is now worth more than the individual plates.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a limited number of individual plates. I went to the Yale Library when I was still living outside New Haven, Connecticut several years ago, and my wife and I stood there all day with one of Yale's 2 sets and turned these giant pages, one of us at one end and the other at the other, and lived through this extraordinary kind of slow-motion movie experience of going through these plates one by one. But you can't do that in an art gallery. You can't do that in a museum. The best places that have these sets, some, maybe Northwestern does this, I'm not sure. They put one of the volumes out where students can see them and then turn one page a day. Mm-hmm. So in 435 consecutive days, you can see the whole book. That's nice.
Yeah, but we just as nice to have it on your living room table. And...
Ah, well, 8.8 million yeah. will buy you a beautiful set.
Who did you say got the one?
The Emir of Qatar. He's building a world-class science library, and this was to be the jewel in the crown.
Mm-hmm. Are there direct lineal descendants of Audubon?
Yes, there are a number. I've not met any of them. I think I may have a chance to meet one this weekend at a Eagle Festival in Connecticut, actually. She lives in Essex, Connecticut, where the festival is being held. I asked a good friend who's a dealer, and he said, well, there are dozens of them, but they don't get along, so they never get together.
Mm-hmm.
His art and his drawings and the copper plates have all been dispersed over the years. They were sold by Lucy to try to survive.
We go back to the phones. 591-7200, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, I'd like to know if Mr. Rhodes knows anything about Audubon being a paleontologist and having any interest in extinct birds and ancient birds and all that. I remembered watching Animal Planet at the same country, New Zealand, that used to have the giant moa, was also home to the Haast's eagle.
Mm-hmm.
That was the world's largest predatory bird, weighing under 50 pounds, that preyed upon humans. Scary, if you can imagine that.
Really? Audubon was interested in birds in Europe, and at one point when he was producing the Birds of America in London, thought about producing a Birds of England as an extra project. He thought up these huge projects, which fortunately he didn't let himself be distracted by. And he had colleagues who had gone around the world. The Liverpool Museum, which has some of Audubon's mounted specimens, also has some from Captain Cook's voyage. I got to look at them when I was visiting there. But I'm not sure he knew about the moa. One of his close friends, a man named Swainson, eventually ended up in New Zealand as a major bird ornithologist studying the birds there. So perhaps that's a connection.
Did you ever go to the house in Key West, Florida, where he stayed as a guest?
That's where I saw my first Audubon. That's what started this whole adventure for me.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
We thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Glad to have heard from you. And directly to another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've listened to your program on and off for the last 24 years or so. And a few weeks ago, you had somebody on who was talking about the possibility of some rogue elements, say, in Pakistan at the university level, having access to radioactive material and possibly turning that over to terrorists. And I've always assumed that the command and control in the United States defense establishment was airtight. But it occurred to me as I was listening to your conversation that perhaps that's not a realistic assumption. Is there any danger in our own defense establishment, either in the operational level or at the research level, of some renegade person or party exploding a device in an American city, and then in the confusion that follows, that could be used as a pretext for an American attack?
Well, you know, one line in the terrorist business that's been totally forgotten is American terrorists. We certainly had our experience in Oklahoma and other places with that. The United States was always a country that had porous borders, unlike the Soviet Union. So while the Soviets developed what our guys at Los Alamos call guns, guards, and gulags as a way of protecting their weapons, meaning the whole country was a big police state, we developed real-time accounting for nuclear materials. And despite some of the things one hears about plutonium stuck in the pipes at Rocky Flats and so forth, the fact is every time any quantity of fissionable material is moved, an accounting record is kept of that move. But Milt says Murphy's Law, so who knows? But I think we keep very close control.
Okay, thank you.
We thank you, sir. And we'll work in one more quick call. Good evening, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd very much like to hear Mr. Rhodes talk about the Star Wars strategic missile defense. What's the latest happenings there in our country?
We tried for the third time a few days ago to test one of the rockets that is vital to this system. and the computer program seemed to have a bad line of code.
It didn't get off
the
ground.
It sent an abort signal to the missile just before it launched, and so it launched and then blew up. So we have not yet had even one test that indicates that this system will work. We have, however, since Ronald Reagan proposed this idea back in 83, spent some $40 billion on this dream. I think it's a wreck and a bust, and it always was. And in any case, it's not a valid way to get to where we want to go.
Well, Margaret Thatcher argues that it was the threat of the mounting of that missile defense, or of the Star Wars system, that bankrupted the Soviet Union.
I know, and I've been reading Gorbachev's memoirs lately as part of the research for this book, and I've also talked to some of the scientists who advised mm-hmm. him, and it's simply not true. He worried about it because his military worried about it. He had been told by his best scientists that you could always defend against it more cheaply by putting mines in space, mm-hmm. whatever. But his military argument was, look, the Americans are spending billions. There must be something in it. Which in that sense, perhaps it did contribute, which is rather ironic since there wasn't anything in it. We just spent the money anyway.
How do you account for yourself? You have a minute to respond to that. You're one of the most prolific. Some people write as much as you do or more, but they don't write at such a high level of quality. You are doing excellent work on everything you touch.
Thank you.
And you obviously keep very busy. Your mind is obviously feverishly active.
It is, and I don't know what a life it's been. This is my 20th book. It's been an adventure to explore all these different subjects. I'm fascinated by the interconnections between different disciplines, and I think that's where I work at my best, is finding new connections. There aren't a lot of people who do that. To do it, you have to be prepared to be a fool most of the time because you don't really know that much about each subject. But I'm used to being a fool, so it's all right. And the reward is you make new discoveries. You find out that there's an answer to something about the Holocaust that you learn by learning about an American criminologist's study of criminals in prison. That's a very exciting thing to do.
By the way, I've got a leftover question on that. I meant to ask you this before, but we had to go to commercials. Christopher Browning did the book Ordinary Men, in which he argues that at least the Ordnungsbataillon guys, who also did that kind of work alongside the Einsatzgruppen, were, quote, as in his title, ordinary men.
I think he missed the fact that these were police. Police, by definition, are trained to be defensively violent. That's their honorable work, by protecting the rest of us. These were also police in what had been for many years a fascist country, and therefore police who used more violence than would be the case in a democracy. They were not ordinary men. They were police officers. Then they had to be conditioned to move into this more serious violence, and that's the process that I was writing about.
Richard, it's been a delight having you here once again, and my mind is buzzing with all sorts of exciting ideas in response to what you've been saying and what you've been writing. The new book by Richard Rhodes is the biography, I almost said autobiography. You must be so identified with Audubon. The biography of John James Audubon, The Making of an American, and that's published by Alfred A. Knopf and Company.